That's right. Okay, folks, let's get started. We have a lot of big stuff to work on this morning, third of our fourth of our four work sessions prior to considering amendments and letting the public come back in and tell us how we're doing. So we're here today to focus on several topics, non-conforming commercial uses, map recommendations, and transportation issues. So I think I got that right. Are we still doing those three?
Yes.
Okay. So with that, I will turn it over to Susan, Joe, and Deborah to take us forward through those issues.
Okay. Just a quick introduction. Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. As the mayor said, this is Deborah Stein and Joe Zender. Also here in a joint presentation is Director Leah Treat from the Transportation Department, her staff, and coming along soon will be both Planning and Sustainability Commission members Chris Smith and Gary Oxman, who wanted to join the conversation on transportation. The mayor mentioned, we're doing these work sessions, so it gives you another opportunity to focus on issues that were core to all of the testimony that happened over the past few months and any other policy or map issues that you still want to discuss. This is, again, an opportunity for you to hear from each other. It's an opportunity for you to begin the debate before the hearings, and an opportunity, hopefully, to find lots of areas of agreement. In your packet on the back of the first page is sort of the agenda of where we're going next to get us over the next couple months to final adoption of the comprehensive plan. We have one more work session on March 1st, and topics at that time will include anti-displacement policies, historic preservation, employment and industrial lands, and any other amendments that you still want to bring up and discuss. Then we'll move all the amendments together in a package for adoption. So if there are any questions now, the first discussion is going to be led by Deborah. It's related to non-conforming commercial uses, and then the second discussion will be led by Leah and her team, and again, we'll talk about transportation policy, parking management, the transportation system plan, TSP, project list, and I think that's it. So I'll hand it over to Deborah.
Good morning. So I'm going to be talking about non-conforming commercial uses. And the reason we've elevated this particular topic for a work session is both because we have a number of map changes sprinkled up throughout the city that fit in this category, but we've also heard a lot of testimony. You've heard a lot of testimony, as did the Planning and Sustainability Commission. So we wanted to raise this issue for a little discussion. It also has both big policy issues and individual property issues involved. So while we're talking about site-specific cases, we really want to tie this all together with some policy direction that leads us to come up with the recommendations that staff provided to PSC and PSC has endorsed. So I'm going to just quickly start with a definition of a non-conforming use, and that is a use that was allowed by right when it was established, or that it or a use that obtained a required land use approval when established, but subsequently, due to some change in zoning, it was rendered prohibited in that zone. So we have a number of these commercial non-conforming uses throughout the city. The situations vary quite a bit. Some of these are in storefronts. Some are in structures that were originally built as houses but have had legal businesses operating. Some are isolated commercial uses within a residential neighborhood, others are in a commercial node. So a number of characteristics that are common to these uses. The real important thing for you to talk about is, why is this an important issue to address through the comprehensive plan update? And as I said, there's a big picture issue as well as site-specific issues. The big picture reason is that our 2035 comprehensive plan is emphasizing complete communities and walkable neighborhoods. So in this context, having small commercial uses, mom-and-pop grocery stores, retail uses, services sprinkled throughout the city provides those kinds of uses to be more walkable to more households in the city. And that's very consistent with the overall policy direction of this plan. And this is a different policy approach than what the city has employed in earlier plans, where there was more of an emphasis on separating uses and saying, that having a commercial use in a residential neighborhood might have some impacts, it's not consistent with residential character, et cetera. We're really looking at a shift in our philosophy and our thinking about having more of these uses walkable. So that's the big picture reason. For an individual property owner, it's also really important to address these non-conforming situations because this update, by doing this change legislatively, we're providing an avenue for remedying situations that otherwise are very costly and are complicated for a property owner to address or to bear on their own. And just to give you a little flavor of what that means, for a business owner with a non-conforming property, they have to document that the use was permitted when the use was established, and that use has to be maintained consistently over time without a break longer than 3 years. And so that's a difficult thing for some property owners to have to document. Any property improvements that require a building permit may trigger a review of that non-conforming status. And any expansion of the commercial use has to demonstrate that the level of impacts associated with the expansion aren't going to increase. That could be noise, number of trips, litter, any of those kinds of impacts. So it really provides sort of a deterrent for some reinvestment in properties, and there's some inherent long-term certainty for a property owner with non-conforming status. And that uncertainty translates into financing barriers, sometimes insurance barriers. So there really is a responsibility or a burden that is borne by property owners. In the worst case, when we have non-conforming properties, there can be disinvestment and a lack of maintenance that can have an impact on the neighborhood. And I think an example of that, a few years ago, we did a legislative process to look at some properties along Killingsworth around 15th, I believe, where there was a stretch of non-conforming properties that had been significantly disinvested. And we got a lot of complaints from the neighborhood saying, could you please address these? These are commercial storefronts, but the property owners aren't investing in repairing or maintaining these properties because they were non-conforming. So that's kind of an extreme example, but common throughout the city. We did. We did a legislative change for that 4 or 5 block area at that time.
Do in this proposed plan map is legalize quite a few more of those.
Right, and by legalizing, what we're really doing is just making the legislative zone map change so they would go from residentially zoned, residentially designated, to commercially zoned, so they're fully legal. Now, to come up with the original proposal, staff combed through records from Bureau of Development Services. We did a lot of field work. We responded to a lot of requests from property owners, and we did as much work as we could to identify non-conforming properties throughout the city. We did not catch them all, and we know that, but we did our best to try and look at the non-conforming situations. And then we used a methodology, which I'll briefly touch on, to look at where we would recommend making that map change and where we would recommend to leave it as a non-conforming property. So among the criteria we looked at in making that recommendation, we looked at, is it on a corridor? Is the use adjacent to or across the street from other mixed use? Is it on a corner? Is the non-conforming use within a quarter mile of a bikeway or a frequent transit service? Was it constructed as a storefront, or was it constructed originally as a house? Does the use fill a gap in neighborhood retail services? And we also looked at, is the structure historic, or does it provide some of the character of the neighborhood, some of the historic fabric or the neighborhood fabric? And if yes, we tried to evaluate whether preservation of the structure is more likely to be viable if the property is designated as commercial mixed use, or is it more likely to be preserved if it retains its residential designation? And some of those cases were important to look at because there was a lot of concern from neighborhoods about preserving the actual structure. I'm going to touch on some examples to illustrate how these criteria were considered in just a minute. As I mentioned earlier, we received, and you have received, a lot of testimony about these uses, these properties. And so I wanted to just briefly summarize the kind of the characteristics of some of the testimony, both in favor of changing the properties from residential to commercial, and some of the opposing testimony. In support of changing these properties from residential to commercial mixed use, We did receive a number of requests by affected property owners to fix their situations. And as I said, that these are property owners who've expressed concerns about the access to financing, so if they wanted to do maintenance and improvements. In some cases, they have trouble filling the vacant spaces and because of some of the constraints on financing and so forth. So they've made requests about their specific properties to change them. We've heard endorsement from many neighbors and advocates for complete communities saying, please, let's have more opportunities to be able to walk to these retail shops and services in neighborhoods. And so having these properties change from residential to commercial was a good thing. And we also heard advocacy from the Bureau of Development Services because they are on the front lines talking to property owners who come in for a building permit without understanding the situation that they may have with a nonconforming property. And so as staff deals with those situations day to day, they said it would be really helpful to remedy some of these situations by making this legislative change. Now, the opposing testimony includes concerns from neighbors about the compatibility of commercial uses. Nonconforming status provides some leverage for neighborhoods. When a property has that nonconforming status, there are some limits on hours of operation, for example, that the neighbors want to hold on to. And this was a very compelling point to staff when we understood that this was something people were concerned about. So what we're actually doing is proposing through the mixed-use zones project a change in the zoning code so that if you have an isolated commercial use that's surrounded by residential properties, we would impose the same limits on hours of operation that we would if it were a property with nonconforming status. So that, we believe, is a way to be very responsive to those concerns from neighbors. And these are cases, again, where you have a commercial use that's completely surrounded by residents. And so if it's a restaurant, let's say, there would be a new restriction on the hours of operation for that.
And will that apply to all such properties or just the new the ones that we're switching?
It would be for any isolated commercial surrounded by neighborhood, so even if it's already existing, that would be part of the new zoning code.
So that might actually change the hours of some businesses that are currently able to operate into the wee hours of the morning and won't be able to.
I'm going to turn to staff. Is that? Sorry, thank you.
My name is Marty Stockton. I'm a city planner, and I'm the Southeast District Liaison. To respond to your question, the way that the mixed-use zones code is being drafted right now is if a site is 10,000 square feet or less and completely surrounded by residential zoning, then we would apply the same hours of operation that are currently in the non-conforming chapter to these sites. So that's the proposal currently.
And would there be a variance procedure so that somebody could go in and say, actually, I do such and such, and that's not bothering anybody, so I want to be able to continue to do it?
My understanding is that that an adjustment could be requested.
And are the hours of operation categorical? So like a mixed use? Marty? So you said there's already hours of operation affecting different uses. Is it categorical, like a restaurant versus a supermarket?
No. So the hours of operation are not categorical. I can't even pronounce that word, but correct. That it's for the sites that meet the criteria of under 10,000 square feet and completely surrounded by residential. So that's so there's no use aspect to this.
And this code provision is still just a draft code. This is one of the implementation projects. The mixed-use zoning code is one of the implementation projects that will follow along. So that code will be as part of the proposed draft that will be reviewed. And there's another opportunity to weigh in.
So, okay. I'm catching up. Sorry. Yeah. I have a couple conversations that I had to get in this morning. But so I think there are lots of situations in which the current nonconforming use is a good neighbor, but the successor tenant might not be.
Mm-hmm.
So if we legalize the New Deal Cafe, for example, if it's picking mm-hmm. And the New Deal Cafe is, you know, replaced by the New Age, you know, dance club.
Right. Well, and that's, I was just about to touch on that. That's definitely one of the concerns we have heard, is that there are fears about a future use. And there is no guarantee that, you know, a beloved commercial establishment may not be replaced in the future by something less beloved. So so that is one of the things that I would encourage you to consider in looking at some of these changes, and that did come up in some of the Planning and Sustainability Commission's testimony as well. One additional issue that we've heard concerns about if we were to change the zoning of these properties is that the existing structure itself, which may have been built as a house or, and again, new, I'm going to show the New Deal Cafe as one of the examples, you know, one-story property, it could be redeveloped in the future. Once it has the commercial mixed-use zoning, it could be developed to the allowance of that zone, which could be a larger scale than what the current structure is. So we've certainly heard some concerns about some of these examples because of that worry that the property may be redeveloped to a larger building.
And what options do we have with respect to drawing any parameters around that? Is it we're rolling the dice and saying you've got mixed use dispersed and you're working off the list just like any other property owner, or is there any middle ground between you're a non-conforming use and we're going to watch you like a hawk, or congratulations, you've got mixed use zoning, you know, we hope you do the right thing?
Yeah. I mean, the first option is what zone is applied. So mixed use dispersed would be the lowest scale, the smallest scale, and for the most part, that is what is being proposed for these properties. But the way the proposal currently sits, that would be the zone that's applied, and there wouldn't be an additional layer of constraints on that property. So that is a shift to something that allows more than what's built today in many of these cases.
Potentially the details of the mixed-use dispersed, which is a new zone, could be different from other mixed-use zones, that it was smaller in scale, less building coverage, whatever, right?
That's an opportunity to look at that. It's not what's currently in the proposal. Mixed use dispersed is the smallest scale, but that is still a code ready for public discussion and your discussion, so sure.
I think there were also comments on the other side saying that there was a small structure in that maybe wasn't surrounded completely, but was on a corner or something, and if it had that people actually would want a larger structure there in the future. And so we don't want to regulate this to the point that those that want to grow a little bit aren't allowed to grow too. So there's some weighing there.
Can we just establish criteria for belovedness and establish a belovedness review committee?
Well, I want to keep brainstorming about particulars here, because I think depending on how we do this, it might work really well or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had experience in the past with applying a general designation and not liking the result. So what percentage of these are food-related?
Oh, gosh.
I bet 80% of them are food-related. It might be a grocery store or a restaurant. So what do we want people really to walk to? Well, the thing we most want them to walk to is restaurants and grocery stores, right? A beauty supply house, well, that's nice, but, you know, odds are most of their customers are going to arrive by car because their market area is much larger. You know, if it was a model airplane store, you know, odds are all of their customers are going to arrive by car because there's a very small group of people in the whole metro area that fly model airplanes. I'm, you know, being playful here,
sure.
But the point is food-related businesses. We had one in our neighborhood until the landlord did a foolish thing, raised the rent, and they left. So it's been vacant 3 years, so I think they're probably losing their non-conforming mm-hmm. status. I don't know, but anyway, the point was it was a beloved, it passed the belovedness test, and it was food because people walked to it because it was food. So maybe we could get creative and have an overlay that said these are food-related. I don't know, but I'm saying there. I want to probe into the question of whether there is a middle ground between congratulations, you've got the new zoning, do the right thing. We hope that you, your successor property owner and your successor tenant 20 years from now does the right thing too, or no, we're going to keep you as a non-conforming use because we've got some control Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a middle ground or not, but I don't want us to just assume that it's this bipolar choice between the nonconforming environment that we're in now versus some new approach. And again, I'm being only a little playful about the food issue. It might be that that would work, because it might be that the most beloved of these are things like the co-op or the restaurant in Glad's Addition or. And again, what are we trying to do? Make sure people walk on local commercial trips. The most frequent local commercial trip is to restaurants or grocery stores. One final editorial point here. We try to plan, and we do a pretty good job, and every now and then just dumb luck intervenes. And we have 200-foot blocks. We zoned a lot of our neighborhood boulevards like Belmont with storefront commercial zoning, and we created a whole new neighborhood called the Pearl District, where those 200-foot blocks grew mixed-use buildings and where we required 50% of the ground floor to be storefront retail. And therefore, we in effect created a whole bunch of 10,000-square-foot commercial spaces with an uncertain market. And we didn't require parking. And therefore, a whole industry. Oh, and meanwhile, we've been fairly liberal about food carts. So the combination of that means a whole industry of locally owned restaurants occupied a huge percentage of that new ground floor commercial area. Chain restaurants could not grok the idea of no parking provided by the landlord. The people, the local restaurateurs said, oh great, I can start a restaurant for less than $2 million. I'm going to do it. We had no idea we were doing that. We just got lucky. And I'm really glad that we got that lucky. So let's try to look around the corner and get lucky again, maybe by intention rather than dumb luck, in a situation like this, because that localism got aided and abetted by planning decisions that we made at a higher altitude, but it really worked out. There were two retail businesses north of Burnside when we sited the streetcar, and they're now 450. A lot of those are restaurants, and a lot of the rest of them are also local businesses, and it wouldn't have happened if we hadn't created a planning framework that biased things towards local. So maybe in this case we can bias things towards, if not just food, at least not obnoxious commercial establishments that are salted into neighborhoods.
Yeah, if I can just jump in here. I question why we even have a 3-year period that you would lose your status. I mean, where did that come from? And if we want to preserve good commercial sites to be whatever, stores and food stores. So I just raise that question. Why do we even have that 3-year lapse? And then I think this is related to what the mayor's saying, but we have a lot, we have a food desert in certain parts of our city, and we have a lot of tired old commercial properties, Gateway, Lentz, areas that could really use and are getting gradually, slowly poised for significant redevelopment. So I want to make sure we're doing something that's going to speak to that. It's going to encourage those properties to be, those tired old properties to be redeveloped into something that will be of value. And hopefully, the Green Zebras and New Seasons and Red Meyers of the world. So.
Mm-hmm. We actually have been looking at that 3-year lapse to question whether that is something we would want to retain or not, or change. And it has changed over time, I think, but that's currently what it says.
And back to my earlier example, we also might want to look at parking. So sorry to name names here, but I, as a neighbor, I'd much rather see a Green Zebra with only on-street parking than a national chain convenience store that insists on 10 spaces for the 2,000-square-foot store. So maybe we can get smart about, again, trying to bias our plans towards the uses that we want, which are locally owned, lightly parked commercial establishments.
I don't have a dog in this fight, but I just want to say that as long as the Supercuts that we walk to in my neighborhood, which is not beloved, and I have to drag my son there, as long as that is not
by him.
As long as we're not discouraging its continued operation, that's the only, I just want to put that on the record.
So, what's interesting about this whole discussion is it shows the pendulum that you see a lot in this comprehensive plan, because the reason that conditional or these non-conforming uses were made to phase out, Commissioner, was the presumption was they weren't supposed to be there. The future of the place was going this different direction. And at one time, that was exclusively one use or another. And we've grown to see more a manageable mix is actually the best thing that we can have. And it's a variation of what the mayor said of, you know, you plan for one thing and accidents happen and they turn out good. These uses still sticking around, they have become beloved. They show that if you can manage it right, these are great things to have scattered around. So we're the pendulum swinging back. We need to look at the data to see how, if we want to, you know, figure out there's a limited type of use or something in these, let's see what the pattern of those uses are. And there's a lot of code complications with doing that, of course, but we can bring that back.
Now, I mentioned that we combed records. We tried to identify a lot of these. We didn't say, yes, we as staff in the Planning and Sustainability Commission did not say, yes, let's change all of these. We were selective based on some methodology. But I also want to note that in this new comprehensive plan map, we may be intentionally creating new nonconforming uses. Again, intentionally, because they may be uses that can continue to operate now, but in our longer-term vision of where we want to go in our particularly urban places, gas stations or drive-throughs, for example, we may want to intentionally make those non-conforming so that eventually they phase out. So we're sort of shifting in both directions. Pardon me? I do know how you feel about that. And so I just want to be clear, we're not erasing every non-conforming use. We may be remedying some that exist today where we think these uses actually are appropriate in a residential neighborhood, but at the same time, we may be creating new ones deliberately. And so I want to be clear about that. I was going to show you a few examples, if that's helpful, just to talk through some of the things you've already. And I have some slides, so they're in your packet, and I, the audience. So this first is the New Deal Cafe, which the mayor mentioned. This is at Northeast 53rd and Halsey. It is a, you know, a one-story restaurant located on a corner. We recommended redesignating this to commercial. It's located on a corner. It's at the intersection of a bikeway, which is on Northeast 53rd, and a transit line, the number 77, and it's four blocks from another transit line. So very accessible as well as walkable. It was originally constructed as a commercial building, so it was intended to be a commercial use from the start. And it does fill a gap in the neighborhood serving retail. And the map shows that it's surrounded by a residential neighborhood. The little pink rectangle is the restaurant. The next example, which you heard a lot of testimony about, is a People's Food Co-op. Food Co-op, and this is in the Hussford-Abernathy neighborhood. Within a quarter mile of a frequent transit line, located on a bikeway, is located on a corner, constructed as a commercial building, and it fills a gap in neighborhood serving retail. We did hear opposition to this from the Hand neighborhood. I think the largest concern I recall hearing, though, was about the hours of operation. And so if this code change that I mentioned earlier is adopted as part of the mixed-use zone, that may help to address some of the concerns.
What would the hours of operation be confined to under the new code?
Sorry, I don't know this.
So in Chapter 33.258, which is the nonconforming situations chapter, there's an hours of operation, which is from 11 p.m. to, I believe it's 7 a.m. I'd have to double check the morning hour, but the evening hour is 11 p.m. Yes. Yeah.
So just while we're on that topic, colleagues, I want to highlight something that came up at the Noise Review Board a couple of weeks ago. And that is the issue of deliveries in mixed-use zones, that as we have more and more residences near mixed-use, and deliveries are specifically exempted in the prohibition of deliveries, so we're having a lot of deliveries at 3 o'clock in the morning that are disturbing nearby residents, and that's something I think we need to address as we intensify the uses, that issue of delivery and garbage pickup noise.
Okay, that's helpful comment.
Yeah, dumpsters being dumped at 5 a.m.
Yeah. Thank you. That's helpful. The next example I want to show you is in the Buckman neighborhood, corner of Southeast 14th and Stark. Quite a bit of testimony about this and just quite a bit of discussion at the Planning and Sustainability Commission. This is, again, within a quarter mile of a frequent transit service, located on a corner. It's across the street from mixed-use properties to the east and two blocks from Central City boundary. So it's a close-in property constructed as a commercial building. And in this case, I think the building is beloved. It's constructed in a way that gives some character to the neighborhood and the neighborhood fabric. I think in this case, the concerns we heard in opposition of changing the designation here was concerns that this beautiful old building might be redeveloped to something larger. What we have found since having the discussion about this property, there are the property owner, it just changed hands. The property owner is in for building permits to do seismic upgrades. So it appears that the economics of actually redeveloping this building as a commercial use, retaining the existing building, is economical, and I think that is reassuring to know in some cases the economics are such that retaining the building is more viable than redeveloping. So,
but is what's being proposed must be legal under R1, right? Because it's R1 now.
That's I think
conditional use.
Non-conforming.
It's a non-conforming.
Right.
Use.
It is not conforming.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the designation proposed may be moot if they're going ahead with non-conforming use permit application now. But
that's true. But for the future, with how about if you just stay up here? Need help with the code questions here.
So this building has non-conforming status for the ground floor, and it has been used for kind of a mix of artist space. There was a small theater that was working out of the building. But the basement, which is actually a very, very large basement, does not have legal status. And so if this property continues as a non-conforming use and there isn't a map change, then the basement cannot be used other than storage. So that's kind of the issue right now with this particular property.
Status, what kind of things could happen in the basement? Because it's obviously not going to be housing. So would it be a nightclub? Would it be what?
The basement is a pretty phenomenal space. Mm-hmm. So the types of uses that you can imagine that would be used in a basement could occur there.
But this is my basement's mostly about storage, so I have a hard time imagining it.
This is in a really hot area, right? I mean, yeah. Revolution Hall's across the street, and there's a lot of other activity in this area. So,
okay. But obviously, the mixed-use urban center designation would allow all those kinds of things. Yeah.
And I just want to clarify that with this particular property. And just really listening and responding to the concerns of the adjacent property owners. While this property we would designate as a mixed-use urban center designation on the comprehensive plan, we have to be clear that the commercial zoning designation would be commercial mixed-use 1, which would be the least intense commercial zone to address, again, the adjacent property owners' concern.
So I have another slide, which is not showing up there, but it's the Lentz Market. And this is east of 205. This change was supported quite a bit by the community. Fills a commercial gap, certainly, in this area, constructed as a commercial building. And it's located within a quarter mile of a Green Line MAC stop. Now, this building is not on a corner, which was one of the criteria we looked at for a lot of other cases, but in this case, it had such strong neighborhood support, and it, as I said, fills a gap. So we did think this was appropriate to change, and the PSC endorsed that. And then the last example I want to show you is on Southeast 52nd and Woodward. This is across the street from Franklin High School, within a quarter mile of frequent transit service. It's located on a bikeway, located on a corner. It was constructed as a commercial building and fills a gap in neighborhood serving retail. And we had mixed testimony about this, both in support and against. Again, I think the concern that we heard from South Tabor neighborhood was about the hours of operation, which we think we can address through the zoning code change. So those were the examples I picked. There may be others you already know about or you recall from testimony, but I wanted to just remind you that you have some choices generally in addressing the nonconforming commercial uses. You can affirm the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommendation, and that would be both to redesignate the nonconforming properties that are in their recommended draft, and then we also have identified, since the PSC made its recommendation, we've identified some additional properties that would follow in this, using the same methodology, the same thinking process we are proposing in the amendments list as well. That would be one choice. You could also change direction and retain these as residentially designated properties and rely on the nonconforming status to remain with the conditions that go along with that. Or your third choice would be to reconsider individual properties. And you may have already identified some of those in your tentative amendments list, and we could talk about those.
Tried to sweep into that package additional properties that have along in discussion and testimony.
Correct, and that leads me into the next agenda item, if you're ready to move up to that, and that's just the review of the BPS map refinement recommendations. And I really hadn't intended to go through any specifics on that list, but rather I wanted to just sort of introduce that list, and that is a list that BPS staff has compiled. They're relatively minor site-specific changes that we identified to be consistent with the recommendations that the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommended. And these just came up in sort of follow-up research or comments from property owners. But
do you have extra copies of that? I don't have any in my binder.
I don't, but I can provide that. And that list was part of the original amendments list, and we can certainly provide that to you. And what I wanted to do is just suggest to you that if you have questions about specific properties where you want more information, I'm more than happy to talk to your staff or to you to provide more basis and to tie it, any property, to another decision that has already been recommended by the PSC, so you can see the consistency of the thinking process on those. Okay, happy to do that.
All right, we can move on to transportation.
Okay. Great, thank you.
All right, great. Well, thank you. My name is Leah Treat, Director of Portland Bureau of Transportation. Thank you for the opportunity to present some opening remarks on the transportation system plan. So the plans that we're deliberating today point the way forward when it comes to meeting our dual challenges of managing our growth and delivering on quality of life, economic vitality, and environmental sustainability. These plans, very importantly, were developed with intense and sustained input from Portlanders, so I don't believe it's an exaggeration to say that these plans are of, by, and for Portland. And as roadmaps to a better future, they also provide us with a guide for investing limited resources. And from the standpoint of transportation, the need for targeted investments is very clear. So you all are very well aware of the condition of our streets in the city. Half of them are in poor or very poor condition. We also have 300 miles of missing sidewalks in the city. And in the last few years, fatalities from traffic crashes have outpaced homicides in our city. An equally sobering statistic is that our low-income and minority communities face traffic fatality rates that are more than double the metro average. I am confident that we can reverse these negative trends because of the choices in response to past challenges. Portland has developed a robust coordination of land use and transportation investments. We have one of the highest rates of public transit use in the nation. And the close connection between transportation and land use is carried forward in the 2035 TSP, which supports the Centers and Corridors land use strategy. And thanks to our investments in safe, comfortable biking facilities, we have achieved the highest rate of bicycle commuting of any major city in the United States. According to the Census Bureau, 7.2% of Portlanders bike to work. And even as the number of commuters has grown since 2000, a third of that growth commuting is in bicycle transportation. That rate is more than double the increase in car commuting trips. So thanks to our past planning and investments, including investments in transportation, Portland is a national and even international leader in fighting climate change. In many cities across the country, the transportation system is a leading source of carbon emissions, but that's not true in Portland. Here, transportation is helping lead the way to shrinking our carbon footprint. And as a result, while our population has increased since 2000, our climate impact, as measured by the amount of carbon we put into the air, has decreased. However, we need to continue to focus on the issues. With the projected 120,000 new jobs and 260,000 new residents by 2035, traffic and climate pollution could increase dramatically. If we maintain today's share of people driving, we'll have 500,000 new drive-alone trips a day by 2035. The good news is if we implement the land use changes, the major projects, the small bike projects, and the stronger transportation demand management policies, we can close almost 90% of that trip gap. And closing the trip gap is essential to meeting our job goals, climate goals, health, safety, and equity goals. And as a final example, I'd cite our work on traffic safety. 2 years ago, Vision Zero was almost unknown here in Portland. But thanks to your leadership, to the work of my staff, and the dedication of safety advocates across the region, it is now the official policy of our city. It is a policy we're putting into practice. We are working with community leaders. We're working with the police bureau, the fire bureau, public health experts to develop a comprehensive strategy for our roads. We've changed how we design our infrastructure so that safety is front and center. And we're making focused investments, to move the needle and get closer to zero. So all of these are examples that demonstrate that when we plan and invest, we can do great things. And that's why I'm very enthusiastic about the 2035 TSP. There's a lot of great ideas in it. And with your leadership and the passion of our fellow Portlanders for their transportation infrastructure, I have no doubt we can turn these ideas into reality. So today, PBOT staff is going to present to you two key policies you've received testimony on, the TSP, the transportation strategy and parking, as well as PBOT's response to some project list comments. So Courtney Duke is going to lead us through the policy questions. Peter Hurley and Zeph Wagner will lead us through the project discussion. And I'll turn it over to Courtney.
Right, yeah, yeah. They are. I'm Courtney Duke with the Bureau of Transportation. And again, as the mayor said, we have Chris Smith from the Planning Commission and Gary Oxman from the Planning Commission here to speak to you, as well as support some of the conversation that we're having today. So thank you for both coming. So again, a number of transportation policy related issues came up in testimony. I have to wear my reading glasses now, so I have to do that. Yeah. So the two that we're gonna talk about today, as Director Treat mentioned, are the transportation strategy, which is policy 9.6, and parking. We also received some language related to trails in terms of amendments that staff is supportive of, and we appreciate the hard work of our city and community partners, and you'll see some of that language in March. And we're also proposing some changes related to the street vacation policies after working with Commissioner Fritz, and so we'll have, again, some actual language about that in March. But today we wanted to talk about the bigger issues related to the transportation strategy, which is policy 9.6, which is the prioritized list of modes. There were three issues that came up both at the Planning and Sustainability Commission as well as in testimony. Those are related to the ADA, to transit, and to freight. So I thought I would talk about each one of those and then have both Commissioner Oxman and Commissioner Smith speak to those and sort of give you the process of what we've done. So in terms of ADA, Commissioner Oxman was very helpful in our work at the last hearing of the Planning and Sustainability Commission about making some changes to the strategy related to ADA and vulnerable users. Staff had some concerns about that related to sort of mixing modes, because an ADA isn't really a mode the way that biking and walking is. But we knew that there were some concerns and needs to have ADA and vulnerable users more highlighted in the comp plan and the transportation system plan. We also heard that from our technical expert group. So we made changes at the last hearing, working with Commissioner Oxman and the team. But since then, Roger Geller, our bicycle coordinator, who's here if we have questions, and I have been working with Gary directly in the last few days and last couple weeks to make some changes to that language. I have a copy of that if we want to pass it out. But basically, we are in agreement to move the ADA language into a policy statement in Chapter 9. So it will be its own policy with adding some additional language and making some changes to the strategy so it doesn't have the ADA in there. And again, Commissioner Oxman has been working with us and is in agreement with those changes. We're also reaching out to our disability partners and communities on additional wording related to the policy statement. Again, we're elevating something that's an objective currently in the transportation system plan to a policy statement in Chapter 9 to address this, the ADA and vulnerable users issues. And I don't know, if Gary, if you wanted to say anything else about that.
Mayor Hales, Commissioners, Gary Oxman, member of the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Regarding the ADA, we heard some very compelling testimony during our various hearings on the comp plan about disability issues for people with disabilities generally, and in particular with transportation. And so having a clear policy statement recognizing the city's compliance with the ADA and the city's intent with regarding the ADA is something that we were very strongly supportive of. And I think, Courtney, did I, if I heard you right, the language is still kind of in process on that. But I think we're at a level of conceptual agreement that we're really very supportive of what PBOT is doing around this. And we think it meets with the community's interests as well.
Questions or comments about that part while Gary is here?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it relates to what we're talking about here or what we just talked about, but you know, I've heard some intriguing thoughts as it relates to ADA, people with disabilities, and the need for continuing drive-through options for food, drugs, coffee. You know, it's not just people with disabilities, it's also older people. Mm-hmm. That drive-throughs provide a more convenient way of getting things done without having to get out of your car and park and all that. So I'm just curious. I know it's very antithetical to our fiber as a being, as a city, but I thought it was a pretty compelling point. Is that something that was talked about at all, or is that too out in left field?
It didn't come up in our conversation. That doesn't mean it's not something we can think about in terms of how we address ADA or address those conveniences. But I think in the policy that we're looking at is more relates to how we design the system and provide the system.
And where we designate for drive-throughs and where we don't. I mean, I think there's some middle ground on this issue. As you know, Dan, I'm kind of an extremist on the other viewpoint. So there are two ways for an older person or someone who with a disability to be inconvenienced by this issue. One is to not be able to find a drive-through. And the other is to get run over by somebody using a drive-through because you're going down the sidewalk with your walker. So it's not a, you know, it's not a clear call about which makes for a better urban environment. But universally, I think we might again distinguish between mixed-use environments and lower-density environments.
You mentioned you were doing some outreach to the Portland Disability Commission. I assume, I guess I'd be interested in getting their input on that topic.
Okay, great.
Between the two polar opposites here on drive-thrus, one thing I'd like to learn more about is there are drive-thrus and there are drive-thrus. So, for example, what Fred Meyer now offers, where there's a zone in the middle of their existing parking where you can pick up groceries that you've ordered, that is qualitatively different than what the mayor is talking about, where you dodge cars coming out of a Starbucks along MLK. And I'd like to know if they're treated differently. Because I understand that convenience of ordering your groceries online and picking them up is taking off. And I would guess, my guess is that older adults are pretty keen on that service. And that seems to me, that is technically considered a drive-through area, but I think it's different from the from the issue the mayor has raised. So I'd like to know if our policy is flexible in that regard.
So I agree with taking the ADA statement and making it its own policy. I'm not clear as to how it then reflects in policy 9.6, where we continue to have cycling prioritized above transit. That's the next topic. Good.
Okay, as Commissioner Fritsch just mentioned, we had some other testimony from Elders in Action and other advocates related to proposing changes to move transit above bikes in the strategy. So I'm going to go through a few points about that, and then Commissioner Smith is going to speak to it as well. So, you know, from a policy perspective, the strategy is really a climate issue. To us, it came out of the green hierarchy that the council has adopted three different times so far in their work, both in the Portland plan, the bike plan, and the climate action plan, all in this order. We don't feel that the change is supportive of the land use transportation vision that we just talked about in terms of centers and corridors. The walking and bikeability of those centers are a key component in chapters 3 and 4 related to the centers. We also worked with a joint modal committee of all of our committee chairs and policy workers and coordinators to craft this language to make sure that it worked best for Portland, following the Vancouver, BC, and Washington, D.C. model, which was, again, recommendations we got from our freight community as well as our bike and ped community to do that. We feel that the change does not help us in how we allocate and use the right-of-way, which is what a lot of this policy is about, of how we're designing our right-of-way and allocating the space within the right-of-way. And moving transit higher up will increase the need for that use of the right-of-way, and again, is not a very climate-sustainable mode at this point. No offense to TriMet and their diesel buses at the moment. We also feel that in terms of our safety and Vision Zero goals, that if we make the system as safe and possible as possible for bicycles and pedestrians, which are therefore safe for all users and safe access to transit, that actually possibly more people will use transit because they have better access to that and feel safe doing so. And then also some fundamental changes that could impact both the comp plan and the transportation system plan is we have some fundamental policies related to transit for trips of more than 3 miles, bicycle trips for 3 miles or less, or walking for 1 mile or less. Changing this priority in this policy could impact those policies as well. So I think that's, and then we had just a couple other things. We've reached out with TriMet. TriMet was on our technical advisory group. They are supportive of the existing change. And we've been reaching out to AARP and Elders in Action through the Age-Friendly Council. And we spoke with them yesterday, and they are understanding what the strategy is about and that there's other places that they can advocate for transit and increase transit service outside of this policy and outside of the comp plan. So we'll be continuing to work with them over the next couple weeks before you have actual policy language.
Colleagues, I'd like to jump in and underscore and add to a bit what Courtney just said, because I think this is critically important. I think it's really important that we maintain the existing order of the modes, as Courtney said, as a safety matter. By designing streets that are safe to walk and bike, our streets will be better for everyone, transit riders or pedestrians or bicyclists when they're getting to transit. Walking and biking make the lightest contribution to climate change. And it's important to note that the comprehensive plan does emphasize transit. There's many policies intended to support transit and access to transit. Policy 924 says transit service in partnership with TriMet, develop a public transportation system that conveniently, safely, comfortably, and equitably serves workers and residents 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Policy 925 is transit equity in partnership with TriMet, maintain and expand high quality frequent transit service to all town centers, civic corridors, neighborhood centers, neighborhood corridors, et cetera. Policy 926 also addresses transit service to centers and corridors. And both the comp plan and the TSP assume significant new transit infrastructure and service. The list of projects that we're assuming happen are Southwest Corridor and Powell Division high-capacity transit investments, a new bus line from Airport Way to Powell Boulevard along 148th Avenue, another new bus line from Park Rose Transit Center to Powell along 162nd, and overall a 92% increase in average weekday transit service hours, including frequency upgrades and multiple lines. I think that we know that But prioritizing the modes this way doesn't mean that we assume nobody is going to take transit or drive. We know some people are going to drive, some people are going to take transit, and some are going to bike and walk. Different types of trips will happen using different modes. And the transportation strategy is about a system working together as a whole. And I feel strongly the best way for that to happen is to design streets for walking and biking and then for transit. I just want to pass out a couple of charts that I think are supportive. One is that demonstrates how much money, in fact, state and federal money, we spend on transit and roads compared to biking and walking. And historically, we spent a hell of a lot more on things other than biking and walking. And another thing I wanted to pass out is Commissioner Fritz and I had a discussion about whether people our age, since we in the council all happen to be the same age and older, can be expected to bike. And what this chart shows is that in places like the Netherlands and Denmark, which have made it truly safe to ride bicycles, people of all ages ride bicycles. It might be hard to imagine given our current infrastructure, but given the right infrastructure, it does happen.
I could add a few thoughts to that. I think Steve and Courtney have made an eloquent case. But I have somewhat unique perspective in serving both on the board of the streetcar promoting transit and being a daily cyclist and a bicycle advocate. And you know, I think I am of a similar age to most of the people on this council. And yes, you can be a daily cyclist. There's nothing preventing us from doing that. I'd urge you to think about the difference between a system that gives people choices and the collective choices that we would like the population as a whole to make in order to enable our policy outcomes that we desire. So absolutely, people need to have transit as a choice. There are people for whom that may be the only viable choice, and we need to have a strong transit system. Amsterdam and Copenhagen can only have a 40 or 50% bicycle mode share because there is also a 30% transit mode share. If those folks who are on transit were in cars, it would not be a fun place to bike. So it's very much about a whole. But I would make the argument that we want as many people to cycle as possible because of the policy outcomes that provides. It's probably, for the distance that can be covered, the least expensive form of mobility we can provide as a public good. A transit trip costs us up to several dollars. Bicycle trips cost government pennies. It's non-polluting and sustainable. There are strong health co-benefits, probably stronger than for any other mode. Yes, on a transit trip, you get to walk at either end, and that is recognized as a positive impact, but that doesn't approach the exercise value you get from cycling. And one that often gets overlooked is that cycling, you're taking your trip at the time and place of your choosing. You're not constrained by the geometry of the transit system or the schedule of the vehicles. So there are a lot of factors that can make cycling a much better choice if we have the right infrastructure. And really, this choice is about the infrastructure we're going to build. And I'd like to illustrate a couple of things I think we would do differently if we maintain cycling in its position in the hierarchy. Right now, the state of the art for new bicycle infrastructure in Portland is the buffered bike lane, like you see on Williams, for example. So you have a wide enough bike lane for two people to be side by side, which is great. And then you have 18 inches or 2 feet of crosshatching between the cars. We know that won't get us the next population group to really consider cycling. We need to move to protected bikeways like we have on Multnomah, where there's physical separation between the cars and the cyclists. That's what will get us from 7% to 25% bicycle mode share. So we need this policy basically as a lever to help us prioritize the funding to do that. And we'll be rewarded with greater mode share if we do that. The other thing it'll do is, as we're considering major investments in corridors, it will put cycling in the right place. So I don't think we will ever say, no, you can't put a light rail line there because you'll displace a bicycle lane. But what will happen is that when we build a light rail lane, we will need to make sure that there are excellent bicycle facilities in the corridor alongside it. And I will relate personal experience where we screwed that up. I was part of the streetcar loop project, and we constructed streetcar facilities on MLK and Grand and made no provision for bicycles. And that is still a black hole for cyclists. We still owe them a way to cross Sullivan's Gulch. You really can't easily and safely get anywhere between the Esplanade and 12th Ave without going a long way out of your way. We would not be able to do that in the future under this policy. And finally, I will reiterate the commissioner's point that the deck is stacked in favor of transit right now. Transit has a multi-billion-dollar federal program that this region and this city have shown great enthusiasm to provide local